These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit.
Broadcasting live from WSNC 90.5 FM, Winston-Salem State University. Welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, the often untold story of Robert Zabukwe and the freedom movement in South Africa, as well as its influence on Steve Biko and the formation of the Black Consciousness Movement. Africa World Now Project is next. Britain took control over the Cape in 1795 and, after relinquishing control, recolonized the territory during its war with France in the early 19th century. Later, Britain seized control of the diamond and gold mines, which was discovered in the late 19th century. After defeating the Boers in the Anglo-Boer War of 1899 to 1902, generally known as the South African War, Britain granted dominion status to the Union of South Africa in 1910. Translated from the Afrikaans meaning apartness, apartheid was the ideology supported by the National Party government and was introduced in South Africa in 1948. An interesting note here is that this was the same year the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted by the UN. Apartheid called for a separate development of the different racial groups in South Africa. Apartheid laws forced different racial groups to live separately, develop separately, and grossly unequally. During apartheid, to have a friendship with someone of a different race generally brought suspicion upon you, or worse. More than this, apartheid was a social system which severely disadvantaged the majority of the population simply because they did not share the skin color of the colonial class. In basic principles, apartheid did not differ that much from the policy of segregation of the South African governments that existed before the Afrikaner Nationalist Party came to power in 1948. However, the primary difference is that apartheid made segregation a part of the law. Apartheid cruelly and forcibly separated people and had a fearsome state apparatus to punish those who disagreed with it. There were a number of laws passed in the creation of the apartheid state. Some of them were, but not limited to, the Population Registration Act of 1950. This act demanded that people be registered according to their racial group. This meant that the Department of Home Affairs would have a record of people according to whether they were white, colored, black, Indian, or Asian. People would be treated differently according to their population group, and so this law formed the basis of apartheid. It was, however, not always that easy to decide what racial group a person was a part of, and this caused many problems. There was the Group Areas Act of 1950. This was the act that started physical separation between the races, specifically in urban areas. The act also called for the removal of some groups of people into areas set aside for their racial group. There was the Promotion of Bantu Self-Government Act of 1959. This act said that different racial groups had to live in different areas. Only a small percentage of South Africa was left for black South Africans. Some other examples of apartheid law include the Prohibition of Mixed Marriages Act of 1949, the Immorality Amendment Act of 1950, Separate Representation of Voters Act of 1951. South Africans, as well as people of African descent, resisted nationally and globally, often developing from organic origins, coalescing in the global anti-apartheid movement. While there have been many explorations in the history and figures of the anti-apartheid struggle, little attention has been paid to the role that Robert Zabukwe played as a thinker and activist in resisting the deeply entrenched racist structures of South Africa. While Nelson Mandela is normally given a certain status in the movement, often presented as the primary symbolic representation of South African anti-apartheid resistance, what is often lost is the deep influence and standards set by Robert Zabukwe, not only Nelson Mandela, but more importantly, the youth movements within the struggle that coalesced into the Black Consciousness Movement. We will begin today's program by exploring Robert Zabukwe as representative of radical anti-apartheid resistance in a commentary titled, Remember Robert Zabukwe. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Brazil, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program.
In the dawning hours of the 21st of March 1960, Robert Mangaliso Zabukwe, left his home in Mafola, Soweto, and began the 5-kilometer walk to the Orlando police station. In so doing, he was personally putting into action his nationwide call for a decisive non-violent campaign against the pass laws. As president of the Pan-Africanist Congress, Sobukwe had called on all black South Africans on this day to leave their passbooks at home, walk to the nearest police station, and demand arrest.
I remember it very well. I took him as far as Chabalala supermarket store and continued to my clinic. It was not far from Mfulu. I went there on foot and they left for Orlando police station.
When we came to Orlando police station, Sobukwe said, "This is the core of my name." That's why evening when we came to them, we told them that we surrender for arrest to you because we can no longer carry the bus. We have had it enough. Enough is enough.
I was there at Orlando police station and Sobukwe went inside and knocked on the door of the officer commanding. I heard at a place called Bofolong, the police had opened fire, and it was thought that at least two people had been killed. And I went across and told Sobukwe, and he was profoundly disturbed by this. He had, remember, sent a letter on the Friday to the Commissioner of Police to tell him about the coming campaign and to ask him to ensure that the police remained non-violent.
Heeding Sobukwe's call, black South Africans presented themselves for arrest at police stations countrywide in their thousands.
I got to the Sharpeville and we got into this crowd. The police evidence afterwards of this threatening crowd, it just wasn't true because I was in the thick of that crowd. And once they knew us from the Rand Daily Mail, all that people wanted to do was to tell me their grievances, and suddenly the shots began.
And in the evening, we read in the papers about Sharpeville massacre. They were really sad. It really broke their hearts.
For Robert Sobukwe, the 21st of March 1960 began as any other day. By nightfall, his actions had determined the course of history in South Africa. 69 people died in the hail of police gunfire at Sharpeville that day. The shooting reverberated around the world and emblazoned indelibly the profile of apartheid oppression on the consciousness of the international community. Caught off guard, the regime was now fully aware of Sobukwe's enormous influence and power. He was imprisoned for 3 years. Determined to neutralize his influence, on the eve of his release 3 years later, the regime passed a bill through Parliament, the so-called Sobukwe Clause, which would enable his indefinite incarceration, as they put it, this side of eternity. Robert Mangalisa Sobukwe, the youngest of 4 surviving children, was born in the township of Umasizake, outside Graaf-Reinet on the 5th of December 1924. It was a hard and simple life. There was no electricity or running water, and the children slept on the floor. Sobukwe's mother, Angelina, had never been to school. His father, Hubert, forced by family circumstances to leave school after Standard 5, was passionately driven to ensure the education of his children. With his meager income, Sobukwe's father made sure that he brought books into the home and encouraged his children to read. Sobukwe attended primary school at the Umasizake Township Methodist Church Mission. With no secondary schooling available to blacks in Graaf-Reinet, Robert Sobukwe waited for 2 years before obtaining financial assistance to go to Healdtown, a Methodist educational institution near Fort Beaufort.
He was the closest friend I had at school. Robert was a voracious reader. He was very keen on English literature, particularly poetry. I remember one that he really loved was Gray's Elegy, "Full many a flower is born to blush unseen and waste its sweetness in the desert air." Now, he loved those two lines. And in the classics, he loved Charles Dickens, particularly A Tale of Two Cities. And also, he loved Baroness Oxey's Scarlet Pimpernel. In biography, he preferred to read the biographies of the chaps in America because he felt that this is where these people started. fighting slavery, you know. He was that sort of man. He had a lot of empathy with other people. Very sensitive, and the sort of chap who would not tolerate injustice. He liked music, and he was also, curious enough, a Christian. He loved church music particularly. And of course, he and I loved the classics like Mozart, Brahms, that sort of thing. Robert was very articulate. His language was meticulous. He was really very well respected because the man was, even in those days, you know, you could see the potential of a leader in him.
Near death with tuberculosis in his final year at Healdtown, Robert Sobukwe rallied to earn a first-class matric pass, which took him to the University of Fort Hare in 1947. Fort Hare was a crucible of intellectual engagement. The roots of Sobukwe's political philosophy are found in the issues of non-collaboration, Pan-Africanism, and African nationalism and the heated debate at the time. He was a founding member of the ANC Youth League at Fort Hare, and in his final year he was unanimously elected as president of the SRC. On his graduation in 1949, Sobukwe had made his mark as orator and student leader.
When I met him, he was already in politics. We met at the Victoria Hospital. I was trained there as a nurse. When I first saw him, I think my heart skipped a beat. It was love at first sight. After completing midwifery, I went to Fryhead, where I was working as a trained nurse. He was teaching in Standerton General High School. I used to write to him and tell him that I'm passing Standerton to Devon or Fryhead or Ladysmith. And he used to come there and meet me. At the Standerton station, on my way to work, we got married in 1954 in Johannesburg. He was teaching at Wits University as a lecturer in Bantu languages.
And I was enormously impressed when I heard him speak in meetings, because there was a strength about him. The Africanists were developing as a separate force, and he was clearly emerging as the leader of the Africanists.
The communal hall in Orlando was the setting for the Watershed ANC conference in November 1958, which saw the Africanists part ways with the mother body. With the adoption of the Cliptown Charter in 1955, the Africanists were concerned that the ANC had discarded the 1949 Program of Action. They were also concerned that the direction and control of the movement was being manipulated by the Communist Party. The PAC was launched at the same venue the following year in April 1959.
And by the end of the year, we were heading for the first national conference of the PAC in Orlando. It was at that conference that one of the most important decisions was taken to challenge the past laws. I remember one single year, 1957, when as much as 368,000 Africans were arrested and charged under one aspect of the past laws. 1,000 people and more per day, every day, on the average, that is what it meant. And Sobukwe saw all this. He understood it. It was his people who were suffering. And the PAC took a decision at that Congress, under Sobukwe's leadership, that we were going to take final decisive action against the past laws. And powers were given to Sobukwe to call the nation as soon as possible. And we were amazed at the simplicity of the plan. Sobukwe decided that on a given day, a local branch of the PAC, under the local leadership, would move to the nearest police station and get to the police station and say to those in charge of the police station, look, here we are. We don't have our pass. The whole idea was that you had to give non-violence a chance. That was Sobukwe's mission.
On Friday, the 18th of March, Sobukwe announced that the moment had come. The decisive nonviolent campaign demanding the abolition of the pass laws and a minimum wage for Africans would be launched in 72 hours. On the eve of March the 21st, Sobukwe tendered his resignation to the University of the Witwatersrand. The following morning, Sobukwe put into practice his call to the nation, and history took its course. Under the PAC banner of service, sacrifice, and suffering, and the strategy of no bail, no defense, no fine, the PAC leadership had placed themselves at the forefront of the campaign. Sobukwe, initiator of the campaign, was arrested with 23 of the executive committee and held at the Johannesburg Fort pending trial. Meanwhile, in the Western Cape, a week-long stay-away intensified the campaign. At Langa, police responded brutally, and history once more took its course.
They moved into Langa. I think it was around 2 o'clock at night, and it was house to house beating up people. Now, on that morning of the 30th of March, here was a situation which was presenting itself, and the PAC, which was the initiator of the whole thing, decided that we are now not marching to any police station, but marching straight to Parliament. And we led this column past Mowbray Station, up Deval Drive, past Grooteskuur, skirting Table Mountains, down into the street that goes straight into Parliament. By the time we reached town, the town was already filled with curious, interested people who just wanted to see what's going on. Unaware that the minister, F.C. Erasma, had given the commissioner of the police for the Western Cape orders that we have to be shot that morning.
And Parliament was sitting, and if Hosana had lifted his little finger, that city could have been sacked that day, and they knew it. Government was in a state of absolute fear that day.
And I'm telling you, we were damn determined. And all that we wanted to talk to the commissioner of the police was that he should set up an appointment with Mr. F.C. Erasmus, the Minister of Justice. Well, they realized they can't move this crowd of 60,000 cramped into the city of Cape Town. After 30 minutes, they came back to say, Mr. Khosana, the minister has agreed to meet you this afternoon. Could you please remove this crowd from the city? And I want to believe that sometimes little miracles do happen, and that our people could stand inside the city of Cape Town for at least something like 2 hours without touching a glass or breaking anything. I asked for the police loudspeaker and just to tell the people that we have secured an appointment with the minister. And I reminded them what Sobukwe had said. When you have reached an agreement with the police, just obey what the police say. And that whole crowd looked back. And I knew that that appointment really meant nothing, except now that I was going to go with a small group of people who would just be locked up.
Philip Khosana was detained on that historic afternoon of the 30th of March 1960. And whilst on bail, left South Africa for 36 years in exile. In the wake of March 1960, the PAC and ANC were banned, and thousands of South Africans were arrested and jailed. Robert Sobukwe was sentenced on the 4th of May 1960 to 3 years hard labor. Your Worship, he said from the dock, we believe in one race only, the human race to which we all belong. The history of that race is a long struggle, and we would have betrayed the human race if we had not done our share. We stand for equal rights for all individuals and are not afraid of the consequences. Sobukwe, having served his 3-year sentence, now due for release, the apartheid government so feared his influence they implemented their Sobukwe clause. This clause enabled them to detain Sobukwe indefinitely. On the 23rd of April 1963, Sobukwe was secretly flown to Robben Island, where he was incarcerated in isolation. The state then extended this incarceration a year at a time up until 1969.
I only knew him starting when we went to visit him at Robben Island. At the time, I didn't know whom we were going to visit. I didn't know that I had a father, for that matter. I think I was around 6. We stayed together with him for the entire 2 weeks, spending mornings, afternoons, and evenings confined inside that place of his. There was no living soul nearby around him. He was kept under solitary confinement for the duration of his stay there. If that's not suffering, I don't know how would you term that. I was just happy when I was around him, even though we didn't talk much.
He was a person who never complained. He just accepted everything. They were just proud of him. Benji was a great friend of my husband. In fact, he was just like a brother to him. He supported him spiritually. And as he came to see us almost every month, he was very supportive.
Once he was on the island, I applied for permission to go and see him. And we had 6 days together. We'd go to an interview room and we'd sit at a table all day long, talking. It was clear he hadn't changed. He was as determined, as certain as ever, about where he'd been and where he wanted to go.
We heard what has told us, your leader is here. And then we were very anxious to see him. Following day when we'd taken to work, we were pulling bamboo out of the sea. We passed that house and we saw him, we knew him. He took up the ground and spread it for us. And then we saluted him, our salute. And then we were sure that it was him.
The routine was a bit difficult because he never knew when breakfast was being brought to him. So it might be at 6 in the morning, might be at 7, might be at 8 in the morning. So you can never be sure when his day was starting. But he would have his breakfast. He liked to listen to the religious program on the SABC every morning. And he would settle down to work. He was doing a university degree, did several degrees on the island. And he would read and listen to music and pass the day as constructively as possible. He fought against the despair, obviously. What eventually happened? He'd been on the island for 6 years in these quite terrible circumstances, never knowing when he was going to come out. Could have gone on indefinitely. And it began to erode him. And there was clearly something wrong. And I think the government suddenly realized that they had a problem on their hands. And they dumped him, quick as a flash. Put him into banishment in Kimberley.
Banished to the township of Galeshiwe, outside Kimberley on the 14th of May 1969, under house arrest and constant surveillance, Sobukwe was able to establish roots, settle down with his family, and study law. In 1975, he was admitted to the bar and established a thriving legal practice. Despite the stringent terms of banishment and the incapacitating fear and intimidation that permeated South African society, Sobukwe continued to articulate his beliefs. His engagement with members of the South African Student Organization, with whom he formed lasting friendships, influenced the nascent Black Consciousness movement.
In Kimberley, we used to sit and talk 50 feet away. The security police would be in their car, just sitting there watching us all the time. The late Steve Biko contravened his bannings, possibly once, perhaps twice, to go across country to see Sobukwe, and that would have been an illegal meeting. He wasn't trying to arouse the population, but his presence was important there. The mere fact that he was there and people knew he was there contributed to the politicization of the community in Galeshiwe.
Bo Malume was modest. He was a humble man. There are a lot of good things we picked up from him. When he was off duty, he looked so handsome in his khaki attire. Working in his garden, we used to stand up and marvel at this wonderful, but what type of a man is this? Such a well-learned man, such a brave man, but oh, so humble.
Oh, he would come home in the afternoons from court. Our shoe store was across the road from the magistrate court, and he'd find a woman crossing the road, and he'd get hold of a bag of potatoes, whatever parcel she was carrying, sling it over his shoulder with his briefcase in one hand and his gown over the other arm, and he'd help her across the road. That was Robert.
The phrase that always resounded in my mind when I would think of him was the one from Chaucer, a gentle, perfect knight. This enormously gentle, courteous person, we'd walk through the streets of Kimberley and there were always greetings for him, and he would politely greet everyone. Didn't matter who they were, he would greet them. He never accepted that he was dying. My wife Anne and I went down, and we spent a Saturday with him in his room, and we talked quietly, and then he'd sleep again. And he told me he didn't believe he was going to die, that he had a destiny to fulfill, and God would ensure that he fulfilled that destiny. And by the end of the day, he was a lot better, but less than a week later, at about 2 a.m, Veronica phoned me to say he died.
He was a very humble man. People used to love him. And I can't say it's because he was intelligent. He used to tell me that, don't say so much about your husband, Zodwa. So I won't say too much about him. I won't praise him now. The people will praise him, not me.
It was as if there was a dark cloud in Kimberley. All of us were asking God, why now? When we thought, here comes light for Kimberley, then all of a sudden, it was dim. A lot of people prepared Malume's funeral, but I tell you, it was painful. The whole of Kimberley went over to Graafrainet.
Throughout his life, Sobukwe held the unshakable belief that in his lifetime, South Africa would be part of a liberated, united Africa. This is the cause to which he committed his life. He was not able to witness his oft-stated dream of South Africa's youth walking tall in a country they call their own. On the 27th of February 1978, Robert Sobukwe, at the age of 53, died of lung cancer. Sobukwe once wrote, "True leadership demands complete subjugation of self, absolute honesty, integrity and uprightness of character, courage and fearlessness, and above all, a consuming love for one's people." Tragically, South Africa has been denied the contribution of Robert Mangaliso Sobukwe. Nevertheless, his legacy lives on.
We were just listening to an exploration of the role and contributions of Robert Sobukwe to radical resistance in apartheid South Africa titled Remember Robert Sobukwe. His inspiration, ideological leadership, and example to seeking an advanced framework towards liberation in South Africa was captured in the paroxysm of Steve Bantu Biko. The framework, as it was formed by Steve Biko and many South African youth, was the Black Consciousness Movement. For Biko, Black Consciousness and the defeat of the inferiority complex instilled by apartheid institutions is a necessary precondition for progress in South Africa, for the African world for that matter. Black Consciousness both inspired and parallels decolonization in the rest of Africa. For Steve Biko, the fact that apartheid was tied up with white supremacy, capitalist exploitation, and deliberate oppression made the problem much more complex. For the advocates of Black Consciousness, therefore, the struggle meant conscious resistance against the dehumanizing and demoralizing effects of apartheid ideology and practice. Blacks were defined as those who were by law or tradition politically, economically, and socially discriminated against as a unit in the struggle towards the realization of their aspirations. The definition of the term black to include Africans, Indians, and coloreds was crucial in the development of the movement. It is worth noting here that neither the ANC nor the PAC had at this time arrived at such a precise and strategic definition which embraced all the oppressed and sought to unite them within a single ideological discourse. What we will hear next is Steve Bantu Biko, in his own words, provide an explanation of the Black Consciousness position and its historical development. Listen intentionally and enjoy the rest of the program.
We see a completely non-racial society. We don't believe, for instance, in the so-called guarantees for minority rights, because guaranteeing minority rights implies the recognition of portions of the community on a race basis. We believe that in our country there shall be no minority, there shall be no majority, there shall just be people. And those people will have the same status before the law, and they will have the same political rights before the law. So in a sense, it will be a completely non-racial egalitarian society.
But will the vast number of blacks, after all their experiences, be able to live a life without giving vent to feelings of revenge, of...
We believe it is the duty of the vanguard political movement which brings about change to educate people's outlooks. I mean, in the same way that blacks have never lived in a socialist economic system, they've got to live to learn to live in one. In the same way that they've always lived in a racially divided society, they've got to learn to live in a non-racial society. They've got many things to learn, and all these must be brought to them and explained to the people by the vanguard movement, which is leading the revolution. Now, the history of it starts off after 1963-64. If you remember this era, there were many arrests in this country, which stemmed from underground activity by PAC, by ANC, and this led to some kind of political emasculation of the black population especially, with the result that there was no participation by blacks in the articulation of their own aspirations. The whole opposition to what the government was doing to blacks came in fact from white organizations, mainly student groups like NUSAS, the Liberal Party, the Progressive Party, and blacks were articulated in any sense were far few by comparison to the olden days, and they were dispersed amongst these particular organizations. Now, when I came to varsity, which was sometime in 1966, in my own analysis and that of my friends, there was some kind of anomaly in this situation where whites were in fact the main participants in our oppression, and at the same time the main participants in the opposition to that oppression. It implied, therefore, that at no stage in this country were blacks throwing in their lot in the shift of political opinion. The arena was totally controlled by whites in what we called totality of white power at the time. So we argued that any changes which are to come can only come as a result of a program worked out by black people. And for black people to be able to work out a program, they need to defeat the one main element in politics which was working against them, and this was a psychological feeling of inferiority which was deliberately cultivated by the system. So equally too, the whites, in order to be able to listen to blacks, needed to defeat the one problem which they had, which was one of superiority. Now, the only way to come about this, of course, was to look anew at the black man in terms of what it is in him that is lending him to denigration so easily. So, first of all, we said as black students, we could not participate in multiracial organizations, which were by far white organizations, because in this country there is an overwhelming number of white students at university. And secondly, these organizations were concentrating mainly on problems which were affecting the white student community. And thirdly, of course, when it came to political questions, they were far more articulate than the average black students because of their superior training. And because of their numbers, they could outvote us on any one issue, which meant that NUSAS, as an organization, gave political opinions which were largely affected by the whiteness of that particular organization. So then in 68, we started forming what is now called SASO, the South African Students Organization, which was firmly based on black consciousness, the essence of which was for the black man to elevate his own position by positively looking at those value systems that make him distinctively a man in society.
Okay.
First of all, we were of the view that this particular country is almost like an island of Europe in Africa. If you go throughout the whole of Africa, you do find aspects of African life which are culturally elevated throughout the continent. But in this particular country, somehow, any visitor who comes here tends to be made to believe almost that he is in Europe. He never sees blacks except in a subservient role. And this is all because of the cultural dominance of the particular group which is now in power.
Now, to what extent have you been successful?
Well, we've been successful to the extent that we have diminished the element of fear in the minds of black people. In the period, you know, 63, 64, 65, 66, black people were terribly scared of involvement in politics. The universities were putting out no useful leadership to the black people because everybody found it more comfortable to lose himself in a particular profession to make money. But since those days, black students have seen their role as being primarily to prepare themselves for leadership roles in the various facets of the black community. And through our political articulation of the aspirations of the black people, many black people have come to appreciate, in fact, the need to stand up and be counted against the system. There is far more political talk now, far more political debate, and far more condemnation of the system from average black people than there have ever been since possibly 1960 and before. I'm referring here to the whole oppressive education system that the students were talking about. And after complaining about this, police, in fact the government, wants to further entrench what the students are protesting about by bringing in police and Saracens and dogs almost soldiers, so to speak. Now, the response of the students then was in terms of their pride. They were not prepared to be cowed down, even at the point of a gun. And hence, what happened, happened. Some people were killed, and this riots just continued and continued. Because at no stage were the young students, nor for that matter, at some stage their parents, prepared to be scared. Now, everybody saw this as a deliberate act of oppressive measures, you know, to try and cow down the black masses, and everybody was determined equally to say to the police, to say to the government, we shall not be scared, you know, by your police, by your dogs, and by your soldiers. Now, this is the kind of, you know, lack of fear one is talking about, which I see as a very important determinant in political action.
Since last June, something like 400 young blacks were killed.
499, actually.
499.
Mm.
And you think that this will not be a deterrent?
No. I think it has been a very useful weapon in merging the young and the old. I mean, before then, there was obviously a difference in the outlook of the old generation to the younger generation. The younger generation was moving too fast for the old generation. The old generation was torn between Bantustan politics on the one side, old allegiances, which were not progressive allegiances, you know, to groups like ANC, PAC, without any resultant action. And there were those who were simply too scared to move.
You condemn Bantustan leadership altogether?
Yes, of course. We condemn Bantustan leaders. Even the best of them, like that. Yeah.
Well, just say a few words on that.
Well, our attitude here is that you cannot, in pursuing the aspirations of black people, operate from a platform which is meant for the oppression of the black people. Now, we see all these so-called Bantustan platforms as being deliberate creations by the nationalist government to contain the political aspiration of the black people, and to give them pseudo-political platforms to direct their attention to. Now, men like Gacha Buthelezi, Matanzima, Mangope, and so on, are all participants in the white man's game of holding the aspirations of the black people. Now, we do not feel it is possible in any way to turn such a platform to useful work. We believe the first principal step by any black political leader is to destroy such a platform and destroy it, and, you know, without giving it any form of respectability. So once you step in it, once you participate in it, whether you are in the governing party or the opposition, you are in fact
giving sanctity to it. You are giving respectability to it. So in a sense, people like Kato Buchelezi, like Matanzima, and like Mangope, are participants in a white man's game. And they are participants at the expense of the black man. And they are leading black people to a divided struggle, to speak as Zulus, to speak as Xhosas, to speak as Pedis, which is a completely new feature in political life of black people in this country. We speak as one combined whole, directing ourselves to a common enemy, and we reject anyone who wishes to destroy that unity. Yeah, we are, as I was saying, of the view that we should operate as one united whole towards attainment of an egalitarian society for the whole of Azania. And therefore, any entrenchment of tribalistic, racialistic, or any form of sectional outlooks is abhorred by us. We hate it, and we seek to destroy it. And it is for this reason, therefore, that we cannot see any form of coalition with any of the Bantustan leaders, even the so-called best of them like Kato Buchelezi, because they destroy themselves by virtue of the kind of argument that one has put up.
Well, the government, of course, as you know, says that all this unrest really is due to communist agitation. Are you a communist?
We are by no means communists. Neither do I believe for a moment that the unrest is due to communist agitation. I do know for a fact that there has been participation, it would appear anyway, from science, by a lot of people in the unrest. But the primary reason behind the unrest is simple lack of patience by the young folk with a government which is refusing to change. Refusing to change in the educational sphere, which is where they were directing themselves, and also refusing to change in a broader political situation. Now, when these young chaps started with their protest, they were talking about Afrikaans, they were talking about Bantu education, and they meant that. But the government responded in a high-handed fashion, assuming, as they've always done, that they are in a situation of total power. But here, for once, they met a student group which was not prepared to be thrown around all the time. They decided to flex their muscle, and of course, the whole country responded. Simply because I was still saying that there are lessons to be gleaned from this whole unrest situation of last year. In the first instance, I think blacks have flexed their muscle a bit, and they now know the degree of dedication that they can find amongst their own members when they are called to action. And they now know the kind of response they will get from the various segments of the population, the youth, the oldies, and so on. And the second lesson, of course, is the response from the government and the white population at large. The government responded in one way, and the white population also in another way. One doesn't want to get into details here, but you know, reading newspapers, you get some kind of idea of the extent of fear that was prevalent in white society at a particular time, especially just after the first onslaught in Soweto, where there was a real fear throughout the community, throughout the country. Nobody knew just where something would happen next.
So how will these lessons express themselves in future?
I'm of the view that any recurrence of disturbances of that nature can only result in more careful planning and better calculation, thereby achieving the desired results to a greater extent than the spontaneous situation we had last year, for instance.
And you believe that by these means you will bring about a real change of the society?
I see this as only an expression, one form of an expression of discontent inside. I'm of the view that the whole change process is going to be a protracted one in this country. It depends entirely on the degree to which the nationalist government is prepared to hold on to power. And my own analysis is that they are wanting to hold on to power and fight with their backs to the wall. Now, conflict could only be avoidable if they were prepared to avoid it. Those who are at the seeking end, that is, those who want justice, who want an egalitarian society, can only pursue their aspirations according to the resistance offered by the opposition. And if the opposition is prepared to fight with their backs to the wall, conflict can be avoidable. Now, we as BPC, I'm a member of the Black Conscious Movement. I was a member of BPC before I was banned, and now I have been, I'm told, appointed as honorary president of BPC. Now, the line that BPC adopts is to explore as much as possible non-violent means within the country, and that is why we exist. But there are people, and there are many people, who have despaired of the efficacy of non-violence as a method. They are of the view that the present nationalist government can only be unseated by people operating a military wing. I don't know if this is the final answer. I think in the end, there is going to be a totality of effect of a number of change agencies in operating in South Africa. I personally would like to see less groups. I'd like to see groups like ANC, PAC, and the Black Consciousness Movement deciding to form one liberation group. And it is only, I think, when black people are so dedicated and so united in their cause that we can effect the greatest results. And whether this is going to be through the form of conflict or not will be dictated by the future. I don't believe for a moment that we are going to willingly drop our belief in the non-violence stance as of now. But I can't predict what will happen in the future, in as much as I can predict what the enemy is going to do in the future.
Can you guess at all at the number of years the change might take?
That's a very difficult exercise. I don't want to get involved in that kind of exercise. Some people say 5 years, others say 10 years. I think we are not at a stage yet where it is possible to fix a precise timetable.
When you speak of an egalitarian society, do you mean a socialist one?
Yes, I think there is no running away from the fact now that in South Africa there is such an ill distribution of wealth that any form of political freedom which does not touch on the distribution of proper distribution of wealth will be meaningless. The whites have locked up within a small minority of themselves the greater proportion of the country's wealth. And if we have a mere change of face of those in governing positions, what is likely to happen is that black people will continue to be poor, and you will get a few blacks filtering through into the so-called bourgeoisie, and our society will be run almost as of yesterday. So that for meaningful change to occur, there needs to be an attempt at reorganizing the whole economic pattern and economic policies within this particular country. PPC believes in a judicious blending of private enterprise, which is highly diminished, and state participation in industry and commerce, especially on industries like mining, gold, diamond, asbestos, and so on, like forestry, and of course complete ownership of land. Now, in that kind of judicious blending of the two systems, we hope to arrive at a more equitable distribution of wealth.
Yeah, but you see a country, sorry, clearly you see a country in which black and white can live amicably, yes, on equal terms together.
That is correct. We see a completely non-racial society. We don't believe, for instance, in the so-called guarantees for minority rights, because guaranteeing minority rights implies the recognition of portions of the community on a race basis. We believe that in our country there shall be no minority, there shall be no majority, there shall just be people. And those people will have the same status before the law, and they will have the same political rights before the law. So in a sense, it will be a completely non-racial egalitarian society.
But will the vast number of blacks, after all their experiences,
yes,
be able to live a life without giving vent to feelings of revenge, of...
Yes, we believe it is the duty of the vanguard political movement which brings about change to educate people's outlooks. I mean, in the same way that blacks have never lived in a socialist economic system, they're going to learn to live in one. In the same way that they've always lived in a racially divided society, they've got to learn to live in a non-racial society. They've got many things to learn, and all these must be brought to them and explained to the people by the Vanguard movement, which is leading the revolution. So that I've got no doubt in my mind that people, and I know people in terms of my own background where I stay, are not necessarily revengeful, nor are they sadistic in outlook. Now, the black man has got no ill intentions for the white man. The black man is only incensed at the white man to the extent that he wants to entrench himself in a position of power to exploit the black man. But beyond that, nothing more. And we don't need any artificial majorities, any artificial laws to entrench ourselves in power, because we believe once we come into power, our sheer number will maintain us there. So we do not have the same fear that the minority white government has been having all along, which has led to these many laws, you know, designed to keep them there.
As you know, the main argument of the government is always that the black man just isn't on a civilizational level at present to pull his full weight politically.
Yeah.
And now, do you think of a one-man, one-vote franchise?
Yes, we do think so, entirely. Entirely one-man, one-vote, no qualification whatsoever, except the normal ones which you find throughout the world.
And you think that the black man, in fact, is perfectly well able?
The black man is well able, and the white man knows it. I mean, the irony of that kind of situation is that when the white government negotiates so-called independence for the so-called trans guy, they don't speak in terms of a qualified franchise. And the trans guy, every trans guy votes, you see? And you get white nationalist politicians arguing that this is a system which is going to work for the trans guy. But somehow, when it comes to the broader country, the blacks may not vote because they don't understand the sophisticated, you know, economic patterns out here. They understand nothing. So they need to operate at a different sort of level. Now, this is all nonsense. It is meant to entrench the white man in the position in which he finds himself today. We will do away with it altogether. There will be a completely non-racial franchise, and the black and white will vote as individuals in our society.
Well, this is all fascinating. As an outsider, visitor, I can only say that my feeling is that this is bound to be a very long and probably a very bloody road.
There is that possibility. There is that possibility. But as I said earlier on, it will be dictated, you know, purely by the response of the Nationalist Party. If they've been able to see that in Rhodesia, Smith must negotiate with the leaders of the black people in Rhodesia. I think conflict is unavoidable given the predictable response from the present system. And this conflict can be pretty generalized and extensive and protracted. My worst fears are that working on the present analysis, conflict can only be on a generalized basis between black and white. We don't have sufficient groups who can form coalition with blacks, that is, groups from the whites, at the present moment. But the more such groups come up, the better to minimize that conflict.
This my newfound disposition. I'm snare chasing, expert word placement, verbatim, burn Satan with fire, the torch bearer. Thoughts follow all be koi sign, chords clever. Your swords ain't sharp enough to sever. My ass a guy. I see you with my massive eye, optimum projection of images from this era. Indigenous, isn't this my vocation, lyricist? Comprehend highly. Imaginatives return wearing goat skins, probably arrested for public indecency. Hey, I'd rather have the chief soothsayer teaching me. Harry was a deep MC, Sarah was a muse, turned into a sex object. Your honor, for her honor, I object to all your theories. Clearly this. Rich conscience, I never bought it. I spit to leave your roots warded. Shine my light for photosynthesis. Pigment, the princess and princesses of royal lineage. Shine timeless, behold the binary. Twin stars combine and the moon makes it a trinity. If you quench down to the bone and you love it where you come from, everybody, what you gonna say? To all my peoples in the front, if you know what you want, everybody, what you gonna say? To all my peoples on the
genocide. If you're feeling the vibe, everybody, what you gonna say? To all my peoples in the rear, with your hands in the air, everybody, what you gonna say? Yo, what you want out of life? Material wealth holds no continuity. When you mummified in a death cave, on the next phase of existence, truancy from the school of life lessons in essence, ruins a truancy. And can ruin these pseudo-heroes, sell heroin, approach pearlies. That adolescent space needed to grow, getting coach early, 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 coach early.
So lick up a louver. This half a evil summer may play. Back in the day, it can say play free. Remember they work your buttons for push up to that day. But if on the woods, your orgasms are fake it. That and the end, you have 5 minutes and you come up for fake it. What a guanic it may dung a lot start. Remember who's
it for me. That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email AfricaWorldNowProject@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moisa Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent Funa Ngonda, and technology advisor is Byron Gray of Great Works Technologies. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC 90.5, a broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Until next week, be peaceful, be safe, and above all, be intelligent.